On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Simultaneous news conferences in Louisiana and Minnesota reacting to these back-to-back fatal police shootings.
Rage and anguish tonight after police shot a 12-year-old boy.
A memorial that was painted right here on the corner of 65th and Broadway in honor of Ezell Ford.
First time in 15 years charges have been brought against an on-duty LAPD officer.
You know, I was born in a world where black murder was normal. My kids were born into a world where black murder is normal, but I don't want to die in a world where black murder is normal.
It seems like there has been a never-ending stream of reports of black people killed by police over the last few years. In the last 48 hours, videos of two more black men fatally shot by cops have gone viral. First, Alton Sterling was shot multiple times by police in Baton Rouge, Louisiana on Tuesday night. And then last night, Philando Castile was shot by police during a traffic stop in Minnesota. His girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, live streamed on Facebook the moments after he was shot. She was sitting next to him in the car. You can see a police officer still pointing a gun at him through the open window. Here's sound from that video, and towards the end, you can hear the cop in the background.
We got pulled over for a busted tail light in the back. And the police, he's covered. They killed my He's licensed to carry. He was trying to get out his ID and his wallet. He let the officer know that he had a firearm and he was reaching for his wallet. And the officer just shot him in his arm. We're waiting for a back. I will, sir. No worries. I will. He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand off it.
Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone.
All right. To talk about what now, we're joined by Roxane Gay. She's an associate professor at Purdue University and contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. Her piece in the paper today is called Alton Sterling and When Black Lives Stop Mattering. Welcome, Roxane.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you.
Great to have you. And also joining us, Malina Abdullah. She's a professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA and an organizer of the Black Lives Matter movement here in Los Angeles. Welcome, Malina.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Roxane, let me begin with you. You obviously wrote your piece before the second video came out. What's your reaction to what we just heard? And what do you make of the fact that she had the presence of mind to shoot that video on social media?
I'm appalled, honestly. I don't know how else I can feel. It's horrifying that she had to bear that kind of witness and that the cop was so hysterical and incompetent in the face of what he did that he couldn't give first aid to the man who was still alive after he was shot. It's overwhelming. And I'm also astounded by her composure. She was really able to stay composed and to, you know, tell viewers what was happening, and I admire her courage.
And Malina, it's likely we wouldn't be talking about this had she not done that.
Absolutely. Again, I think it points to exactly what Roxane is saying, to the thought and courage of the woman, the mother, with her child in the back of the car. And it also points to a time that we live in where black people have to be constantly thinking about how will I conduct myself, because it's happening so frequently that these killings at the hands of the police are likely to hit us personally someday.
So that we should always be ready to document?
Always. And I think that if you watch the video through to the end, I think that there's also kind of some telltale signs of what the police do, because the police
indicated that they were attempting to confiscate her phone. What they weren't ready for is that she was live streaming, not simply recording. We know Minneapolis has a history, a recent history, if we think about Jamar Clark, of confiscating video evidence. And so I think it was really brilliant of her to live stream it so that that video could not be confiscated.
And Roxanne, in your piece today, you wrote that when you first you heard about the Alton Sterling shooting, you said you felt so very tired, and you wrote, "I don't know what to do anymore." What did you mean by that?
You know, it's just really exhausting to have to see this happen time and time again. But I also recognize that my exhaustion is a luxury because I'm alive to be exhausted, and so many of these young men and women, or actually men and women of any age that are murdered by the police, no longer get to be exhausted by reality because they are no longer alive and their families must mourn them. But at the same time, it does take a toll to see this kind of video and to see the reality that the videos are offering us of how little Black Lives Matter. I'm exhausted. And I'm fighting against that exhaustion, but we should all be exhausted, and we should also, I think, be equally outraged that this continues to happen.
And Melina, as an organizer of the Black Lives Matter movement here in L.A., you know, what do you say to that feeling of exhaustion? I mean, how do you keep the movement energized?
So I think that, I mean, it's natural to want to be exhausted. I think that as a piece of the continuum of Black freedom struggle, a struggle that we inherit from, you know, our ancestors from the moment we were captured from Africa, we must resist this idea of being exhausted. And so last night there was a gathering in Lamert Park, about 150 people showed up. Most of them, many of them were brand new. And there was a very young sister, maybe 19 years old, 18 or 19 years old, who started crying and said, you know, we can't grow numb to this. And there were echoes of, and we can't get tired. So we can't grow weary. I'm sure Harriet Tubman was sick of going back, right, and freeing enslaved people. But there was something in her that said, I must go back, and we have to continue to go back. We have to continue our struggle for liberation. We can't let any more 4-year-old girls have to comfort their mother and say, I'm right here with you, or 15-year-old boys break down and say, I want my daddy. You know, we can't afford to get exhausted. So when Sister Roxanne is saying exhaustion is a luxury, it's a luxury that none of us can afford to succumb to. We have to get up. Even when we don't want to, we have to get up and summon strength and love and power from wherever we get it.
Now, the Department of Justice announced almost immediately that it's going to investigate the Baton Rouge shooting. Do you see that as a sign of progress, that prosecutors are more willing to examine police misconduct?
Yes and no. I think it's a sign of progress. And they're also going to investigate what happened in St. Paul, Minneapolis. But it's not that they investigate, it's the outcomes of the investigations. They found Darren Wilson not culpable, so I don't have a lot of confidence in the Department of Justice, but I do think that we're seeing the Department of Justice respond more effectively and more quickly to these kinds of crimes. And hopefully someday that will mean something. But right now, I don't think it means much of anything.
And the president also weighed in on Facebook today. He said he was, you know, appalled as well by what happened, but he couldn't really comment further because of the DOJ investigation. But he said he convened a task force a couple of years ago to come up with recommendations, one of which is to have more and improved community policing. Melina, what do you think of that? And do you see that happening on the ground in L.A.? And do you think it's enough?
Absolutely not. It's not enough. And one of the things that I think these killings and the rapidity of these killings, that they're happening every day. We haven't even talked about what happened the day before Alton Sterling. There was a Black man killed in New York. And so we need to, I think about that. What's happening is, I think, for the people, it's illuminating that an entire system of policing, the structure of policing in this country, is built in a way where all of these kind of pieces of the puzzle are connected to and kind of conspire to produce these outcomes. These outcomes are not accidental. One very quick example of why I don't have much faith in the Department of Justice and in the Task Force on 21st Century Policing that you mentioned is it is these bodies that have decided, for instance, to award 6 model cities for their police work. One of those cities that is being recognized is Los Angeles. Los Angeles is also the home to the most murderous police force in the entire country. So for 3 years running, this being the third year, Los Angeles leads the nation in killing its residents. And the Department of Justice, as recommended by this task force, is honoring LAPD, which both leads the nation in killing and in the prosecution of protesters who say, dare to say, don't kill us.
And no Los Angeles Police Department officer has faced criminal charges for an on-duty shooting, I believe, in the last 15 years. I don't believe there has been a prosecution.
Right, not a single one.
Right. Well, should that be the answer, Roxanne? Should there be more prosecutions and more vigorous investigations on the end of, you know, the aftermath of the shootings, or does the problem exist before that, and that's where it should be addressed? Michael Tomasky wrote 2 years ago, he's a journalist, he wrote that the problem starts in the instant of electric mistrust when the cop reaches for his gun. So that's beyond the reach of legislation or punishment. It's the moment before the shooting happens, and that's the part that needs to change. And how do you do that if that is indeed the case?
You know, we need a multi-pronged approach to solving this problem. It can't be any one thing, but we can't throw our hands up and say, oh, we need to solve the problem earlier, because the problem is here and now. And Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, they need justice now, and their families need justice now. And so we do need to see prosecutions. We need to see some kind of deterrent, because right now the reason that police officers continue to murder Black men and women is because they can do so with immunity and impunity. There are no consequences for their actions, and so we need consequences. And that requires prosecution and incarceration, even though, of course, we can and should critique our prison system, which does not rehabilitate in any way. At the same time, we need to look at education, not only within police training, but in our society as whole. How do we get people to see Black men and women, and people of color more broadly, as human beings? How do we get them to value Black life? And I don't frankly know that that's something that can be taught, but as a teacher, I have to believe that we can try, and instill more empathy and humanity in people so that police officers don't instinctively reach for their guns. And then we have to look at their training and how they engage with community. They spend far more time on the firing range learning how to use their guns than they ever do learning about mediation and conflict negotiation. So we're not teaching police officers to police. We're teaching them to be soldiers, and that absolutely has to change. And so I think if we take that multi-pronged approach, maybe someday it will get better.
Roxanne Gay is an associate professor at Purdue University, a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times as well. And Melina Abdullah is the chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA and an organizer of the Black Lives Matter movement here in LA. I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And we want to hear your thoughts on all of this. You can call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach out on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Shani Jardin sent a tweet out Saturday night. It's been retweeted now more than 50,000 times. We'll talk about how she inadvertently touched a nerve in the Muslim world next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24, programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Social media is a breeding ground for xenophobia, for sexism, racism, all sorts of unpleasantness. But there are times when it can spread a more positive message. Shani Jardin has seen both sides of this digital coin. She's here now. She's co-editor of BoingBoing.net, a regular web and tech commentator as well. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's begin briefly by setting the stage and talking about the bad.
Yes. The internet is a big, complicated place, just like the offline world. And it's a place where people go to vent their frustrations and be unkind to strangers as a method of stress release. I don't know.
And you personally are at the receiving end of a lot of this.
I mean, I'm a woman on the internet writing about technology and politics and whatnot.
Right,
and
that's all you need to be.
That's pretty much all you need to say. Guys get it too. Women get a particularly virulent brand of hatred a lot of the time, especially when one of us has the audacity to write a political tweet about a hot button issue, we can expect rape threats and death threats.
That's nice. Okay, so you received some negative feedback, but a lot more positive feedback for a tweet that you wrote recently that unexpectedly went viral.
Yeah. So over the July 4th weekend, I think all of the news hounds who listened to Press Play followed these horrible attacks, the suicide bombings, ISIS suicide bombings in Baghdad, in Bangladesh last week, in Turkey. They're really selecting targets that are of importance to Muslim people. Mm-hmm. And one of them was at the Holy Mosque at Medina. And with all of the crazy politics going on around our presidential campaign, I just, in the middle of the night, before nodding off on Friday, I tweeted that, you know, we're confusing ISIS with regular Muslim people.
Okay, so let me read it. It said, what you wrote, "Dude, ISIS is bombing Muslim people in Muslim communities during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. How is ISIS Muslim? No, they're psychopaths."
Yeah, it was just a random thought, and I went to bed. And then the next morning, there had been another attack, and somebody in the Mideast with a large follow count had retweeted this in Arabic with some commentary saying, "Oh my God, there's somebody with half a brain in the West who understands that we are not ISIS. We, who are devout Muslims, who are, this is like the last day of Ramadan, we're about to celebrate the festival, the Feast of Eid, with our families." This outpouring of grief started on Saturday and accelerated in velocity through Monday afternoon. And all of a sudden, there were all of these young women wearing hijab sending emoji flower bouquets at me and saying, "Finally, a Westerner who gets it. Thank you for appreciating that we're human beings."
So at this point, how many tweets and retweets of this?
I didn't check this morning, but the last time I checked, it was 50,000.
Oh my gosh.
And I can look at the impressions on Twitter. In other words, the number of people who've seen it, whether or not they've retweeted it or liked it or respond to it. That's like 3 million a day.
Wow.
I didn't know that many people existed.
Has that ever happened to you?
No. And certainly not in a friendly way. This was like a love mob. And for 3 days, all these people from... Like, I'm huge in Bahrain now. But I've been around on the internet long enough to know that moments like this aren't about the individual, and that the really exciting thing is to share that lightning bolt moment with people whose voices are not heard. So I suggested to all of these new followers from Bangladesh, from Pakistan, from Saudi, they all were like signing the tweets saying, "Algeria is very glad that somebody stood up for the dignity of the Muslim religion." One man said, "Oh God," he said, "this tweet was like the light of the moon shining in our moment of greatest darkness and grief." And I think, you know, I'm a grown woman now, and I know that that is not about me. That is just about the magic of the moment. So I suggest to everyone in news who's listening to this broadcast that the next time you say moderate Muslims need to speak out strongly against ISIS, to condemn ISIS and to say that this has nothing to do with the Muslim faith and the Muslim identity, you can just look in the responses to my tweet. It's all there, thousands of them saying exactly that. You know, a friend of mine who is a journalist working in the Middle East, when he first saw this, he said, be careful. Be careful. Like, you could be on ISIS's hit list now. I'm like, dude, I work on the internet. I'm on a lot of people's hit list. I'm here in California. I consider myself safe enough. The people who are sharing this and who are so moved by it are in the countries where the attacks are happening now. And it's just wild that, like, this radical act of treating a group of people as if they're human beings could elicit such a response. You're not a hero for doing just the basic right thing. And I feel like that's what this was, just acknowledging the humanity and opening up a little place, a little moment on Twitter where people could recognize that. You may say I'm a tweeter, but I'm not the only one. I hope one day you'll retweet me and the world will live as one.
Did you just make that up?
I did.
Again, an example of brilliance. Shetty Jardin, co-editor of boingboing.net. Hey, we're going to have a link to the story you wrote for The Guardian about this. And you were retweeted by tens of thousands of people around the world, as you said, 50,000 times and counting. We reached out to one of them. This is a guy from India.
My name is Amanullah, and I'm 22 years old. I'm from capital city of India, New Delhi, and I'm right now I'm pursuing my engineering degree.
How did you first see Shani's tweet, and what did you think?
There was this screenshot on Facebook, and then I searched for on Twitter. It was very heartwarming thing for me, because getting such a response from a person from a Western country was very nice to know, because these days all the people are bashing Muslims. They are saying that Muslims do this, Muslims are radicals, Muslims are extremists. At the same time, someone is telling you that no, there are certain types of bad people in every community and there are certain good people in every community. So you can't label all of them all together. So I shared it, because if someone is doing good things, then it is your duty to say thank you to that person. Because someone is trying his or her best to make this world a better place.
And you wrote, thank you, Shani, for being our voice in the time of sadness. We all belong to a big human family. And then you put two heart emojis next to that.
Yes.
Other people have said similar things in the West. She's not the only one. What was it about her message in particular?
She was very clear, because those people, those extremist people, does not represent our religion, because those people are psychopaths.
And there's also been another story that the West has not really responded to the various bombings, the bombings in Baghdad, the bombings in Bangladesh, and lots of Muslims were killed in those ISIS attacks. And there is a response there saying, well, where is the Western concern for these victims?
Yes, absolutely. Even on Facebook, you will see whenever there is an incident or tragedy that takes place in the Western countries, there's an option to change your profile flags and everything. But whenever there's a blast in the Muslim country or in the Asian country, there's no response from Facebook. No such response from Facebook, and even the media in the West always talks about the things, the tragedies that happens in West, and never ever we hear about the incidents that are happening on the daily basis in Iraq, incidents that are happening on daily basis in Libya, and in Syria, in all these countries. They don't even make the news on prime time. So it is, you know, very frustrating for us to see that those psychopaths are not killing only non-Muslims. They have killed more Muslims than non-Muslims. And we are, like, the normal people, the normal Muslims, we are struggling in our day-to-day life. We are struggling to earn our bread. We go to school, we go to colleges. And then we hear all these type of remarks like, you're a terrorist, because of the mainstream media. So it is good that the people, there are so many good people in this in the world, they are coming forward and they are saying that stop this discrimination.
Well, thank you very much, and happy Eid.
Oh, thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Take care.
Coming up on Press Play, deep inside the world of romance novels.
All of the big publishing houses have a romance division, and those divisions are really keeping the rest of fiction afloat.
How romance novels have quietly shaken up the publishing world, that's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Romance novels don't show up that often on the bestseller list. They don't win the big book awards, but tales of love and lust are huge. One estimate is that they're a fifth of all adult fiction sales, and that's more than $1 billion of books sold every year. That's largely because romance readers are voracious. Almost half of them read at least one book per week. They're a diverse group of people from around the world, but they share one thing in common, a desire for HEA, as it's known in the biz, or happily ever after. A new documentary takes a loving look at the world of romance novels.
You know, people will say, well, Romeo and Juliet, and I will say, no, no, not a romance, tragedy. And there were two stupid teenagers who committed suicide. It is not a romance. When I pick up a romance, I want a great story with interesting people who go on a journey together.
Lori Kahn is the director of Love Between the Covers. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Okay, so a loving look at the world of romance novels. That's kind of a bad pun. But I get the feeling you really have a warm feeling for this world. Are you a fan of romance novels?
I actually did not start as a fan of romance novels, but I'm really interested in communities of women because they rarely make it onto the screen. And especially these communities that are huge, that are very successful, that nobody takes seriously. So it's like, whoa, there must be something there to look at. And I jumped in the deep end not knowing much and was just surprised by what I found.
Well, how big a business is it? I gave some statistics, but could you flesh them out a little bit?
It's huge. I mean, all of the big publishing houses have a romance division, and those divisions are really keeping the rest of fiction afloat. It's wildly successful. And the readers of romance novels are voracious readers. And women in general read more than men do. So here's this genre of by women, for women, about women, where women are always central characters, which doesn't happen very many places in popular culture.
And the sales figures are huge, and yet the genre still doesn't get the kind of respect that regular fiction, for lack of a better word, gets. Why is that?
Well, I think all genre fiction is thought to be lesser than kind of high literature, you know, real literature, as some people call it. But if you think about it, a lot of the real literature that's out there is really awful. I mean, some of it's brilliant and some of it's awful. And the same thing can be said of genre fiction. But what's more interesting to me than comparing romance with, you know, high literature is comparing romance with mystery, sci-fi, westerns, all of the other kinds of genre fiction that are meant to be page turners. They're entertaining. They're, you know, an escape on the beach or on the train. And you know, romance is treated differently than the others. I mean, a lot of people who I interviewed said that they would be on a plane, on a beach, and a complete stranger would walk up to them and say, "Why do you read that trash?" And that would not happen to a man reading Stephen King or David Baldacci.
And you think it's just solely because these are women's books?
I do.
But what about the covers? Now, not to judge a book by the cover, but you do judge a book by the cover when it comes to these. And the covers are carefully constructed, but they are kind of cheesy. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that covers are marketing tools. And I think that people who read romances are looking for something that speaks to them from across the room. And so they're very different. I think everybody thinks of Fabio and bodice rippers when they think of romance covers. And there mm-hmm. still are historicals that are lusty characters in historical garb. But there also are paranormal romances. There are very chaste evangelical Christian romances, which look like sort of sweet country scenes typically. There are, you know, contemporaries that are look like chick lit, you know, someone on the beach being swung around by their partner with their feet up in the air. You've got lesbian romances and African-American romances, erotic romances. So the covers are much more varied than people think, but they are meant to grab your attention. I dare say that, you know, the covers of other genre fiction are not a lot more sophisticated. You know, they're also meant to be marketing tools from across the room.
So they all end, as I said earlier, with this HEA, happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ever waver? Do they ever not have a happily ever after?
You know, a lot of people would say to me, oh, God, they're so formulaic. They always end happily. And I'd always say, well, wait a second. I mean, what about mysteries? There's a dead body at the beginning. Guaranteed it's going to be solved by the end of the story. What's the difference? Or a sci-fi novel in which there are alien invaders. And I guarantee that the alien invaders who are evil will be repulsed by the end of the book. And it's really the same thing with Westerns. I mean, genre fiction, all genre fiction, is really about good and evil. It's about archetypal virtues. I mean, the way people get their happy endings is by becoming more courageous, more virtuous, more loyal, better able to love.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Lori Kahn. She's the director of Love Between the Covers. That's a new documentary about the world of romance novels. One of the women in your movie, Mary Bly, she's the poet Robert Bly's daughter. She says that the same themes exist in romance novels that exist in literature: loyalty, love, loss, courage, cowardice. And you note that Jane Austen is considered the icon of the romance novelists.
The Ur Mother.
But her books are considered literature, high art. The same with the Bronte sisters. What is the difference?
Time. I mean, Jane Austen was not considered high art in her day, and a lot of women writers were dismissed when they were writing. I mean, novels have been written by women since the very beginning of novels. And, you know, it wasn't until 100 years after Jane Austen wrote that she was sort of elevated to be part of the canon. And the kinds of romance novels that are being written today, authors have to write 2, 3, 4 novels a year to survive financially. And so some of them are well written and some of them are just turned out, but they're meant to be page turners. You know, they're exciting. They're like a roller coaster ride, like all genre fiction. You know where you're going to end up. Like the crime will be solved. You know, the bad guys will be vanquished. Love will win out. But it's all about the journey. It's how you get there.
But is it more like dessert rather than a full meal? In other words, you're getting all the excitement, the titillation, but you're not getting the substance of a novel?
Well, it depends. I mean, they frequently give romance novels to women in battered women's shelters, saying, look, here's a person who got out of a bad marriage and found a decent relationship. And you also deserve a loving, decent, nonviolent relationship. And I don't think, I mean, there are many people who tell stories about people, readers of theirs, who have gotten through the toughest times in their lives by reading about other people who got through very tough situations.
It seems that there is a very strong community that you profile in your movie based around romance novels, that a lot of women who maybe were going through some difficulties found solace with each other, not only through reading the books, but through forming these communities with like-minded readers. How is that important to creating the market for these books?
Well, first of all, the people who read romance and write romance have a higher percentage of successful long-term relationships than the population at large. So we're not talking about lonely, pathetic people who hanker for a relationship because they just don't have any in their lives. But I do think that the people who read romance are fundamentally optimistic. And I think that they read these books because they're exciting. And depending upon how much, you know, how hot, that's the term in the business, how hot they want it to be, as in how much sex, you know, it can be a whole range. But they all will end optimistically. And people, women in particular, get what they want. Women can explore their desires unapologetically in these books. And there aren't very many places in the culture where that's possible.
Well, I guess for men, it's porn.
Yeah, but it's different. Romance novels are about the relationship fundamentally. And romance novels are about seeing a couple get through difficult things and find their happy ending. And I think that the books are about those relationships and about the possibility of a good, decent relationship and the hope that one has that you can have it as well.
Right. So it's not just the sexual part, but also the fantasy of a romance, which is, you know, stereotypically what women like, and as opposed to what stereotypically men like.
Well, romance is pretty broadly understood these days. I mean, a lot of the heroines are not blushing virgins waiting to be carried away in the sort of archetypal romantic fashion. I mean, the women who are heroines in these books are CEOs and surgeons and lawyers, and they run shops and they are fire, you know, they work for fire departments. I mean, there's a whole range of, they're even Navy SEALs. So there's a huge range of kinds of people. And there are still some virginal, passive heroines, but not many. I mean, most of these women who are main characters are pretty kick-butt heroines.
How has the industry changed since the dominance of Harlequin? When I was growing up, it was Harlequin. That was it. See, Harlequin romances. But now it seems like it's so much more diverse. How did that shift happen?
It's interesting. So Harlequin is part of, it's the Canadian part of Mills and Boone, which is English. And those were those little books. They're much smaller than the big fat paper books that you see mostly now. And they were sold like magazine subscriptions. People would say, I like this line. I like the, you know, Temptation line. I like the Blaze line, whatever it is. And they would get, you know, a book every month. And it was less important who the author was. And they were sold as sort of commodities, as, you know, the kind of thing you were guaranteed to like. And the big publishing houses noticed how much profit Harlequin was making. So the big publishing houses started their own romance division. So we're talking about Random House and HarperCollins and St. Martin's and Penguin. They all started their own romance divisions. And then about 30-some-odd years ago, the Romance Writers of America was started, which created an environment that was really supportive and where people could learn how to be better romance writers. And they had conventions, and they have like 140 chapters all over the country now. And they meet on a monthly basis at their local chapters, and they have regional meetings and then one big annual conference every year. And that also helped to strengthen this notion of a community and people teaching each other how to do things differently.
You said that you have to publish at least two novels a year to be financially solvent or successful.
Yeah, if you quit your day job, yeah.
Yeah. So it seems like the margins are small for the writers. Who's making all the money?
Well, the people at the top are making really big money. I mean, I've heard that Nora Roberts is worth about $350 million. And she makes, you know, many millions of dollars every year. She writes, she's very disciplined, and she writes 5-6 books a year. And they always shoot straight to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. And there are about 30 or 40 writers who sell incredibly well, and it's very profitable. Then there's a whole mid-list range, people who can earn enough to live a decent life, but they're not in the sort of megastar level. And then there are people who just keep their day jobs and they just really enjoy writing. And, you know, they're not making much, but it's a passion.
It would have to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thanks very much, too. I mean, it's an interesting community that people think they know about, but it's actually quite different than what they all expect.
Lori Kahn is the director of Love Between the Covers. It's available this Tuesday on iTunes, Amazon, and wherever you find your streaming movies. Lori, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on this program, the Williams sisters at Wimbledon, Olympic athletes pulling out of Brazil, the games, the Olympic Games there, the Warriors are getting a big NBA star. The Sklar brothers are here to break it all down. That's next on Press Play.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Randy and Jason Sklar, a.k.a. the Sklar Brothers, are here to talk sports. Hey there.
How you doing? You know, hello. I was just watching the Fernando Valenzuela documentary on ESPN, and that's where that quote from our opening comes from.
Really?
The sound of the cheering crowd tells it all. That's Vin Scully calling Fernando Valenzuela when he had won basically like 8 games in a row as a rookie, his first like 8 games.
It well, you guys are heavy hitters.
Thank you.
There you go.
Los Angeles treasures.
Okay, let's talk about Wimbledon first, and we'll start with the Williams sisters. One is in and one is out.
Yeah, I kind of...
Venus got farther than we thought she would this
which
year.
Which is that Venus just being amazing because she is older, you know, she's older than Serena and she's older than most tennis players at that.
Tennis players hit their 30s, certainly women's tennis players, they start, you say, wait, where did they go?
She's 36.
Yeah. And Serena's older as well, but still having a lot of success. But you say to yourself, is the women's game not good enough to where an older Venus Williams can just run through the draw and actually make it to the semifinals? Or is she that good? I don't know the answer to that question.
She's really great at Wimbledon. She has an amazing record. Like, as far as Grand Slams go, Wimbledon
that's
was
grass
the best
is her surface and how she does well. And it basically, she's won 5 titles, Venus. Serena's won 6 Wimbledon titles.
Venus has been to the finals 8 times. The 3 times she lost were
to her sister.
Sister.
So I know it would set up nicely for that, but it's not going to happen. But Serena has a chance to, in the finals, tie Steffi Graf's 7 Wimbledon titles. So we'll see how her nerves are. She got really nervous at the French Open and lost in ways that a veteran like her you wouldn't expect, but we'll see. I mean, both draws are great. Wimbledon's excited because the men's draw is fascinating as well right now.
Well, you have a Brit. You have Andy Murray, who's arguably the best British tennis player, male tennis player of all time.
Since Fred Perry, let's be honest.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he's really a talented guy.
He won in 2013.
He has a chance to potentially win here with Djokovic out of the draw.
Andy now, Murray's, how did he get out of it?
He lost to Sam Querrey.
That was an upset.
That was a huge upset. Sam Querrey, U.S. tennis player. There aren't a lot of great. John Isner and Sam Querrey are like the two, and Jake Sock are the 3 best men's players, and they're all around 15 to 25 ranked in the world. They're not in the top 10. These aren't guys who are going to win tournaments. So when Sam Querrey, he beat Djokovic.
The number one player in the world.
And then Djokovic was going for the Grand Slam, winning every single Grand Slam in order this year, and he almost did. He won the French Open for the first time, Djokovic. So coming off of that, you thought, okay, he's got a tremendous amount of momentum. Then he loses to this American, Sam Querrey, and Sam Querrey won another match but then lost. So what you have set up right now is a potential final with Andy Murray from England.
Hometown hero.
And Roger Federer. It would be exciting and amazing, and people love Roger Federer.
Okay, let's talk about the Olympics. We keep hearing about all the problems in Brazil. They're not prepared. There's, you know, Zika
bad drinking
virus.
Zika
the
is big.
The sewage is terrible.
I know.
There are muggings at the volleyball courts.
The police are on strike. They don't want to, you know, they're not getting paid. I mean, it's a bad situation down there. The Zika is probably the biggest story in terms of keeping athletes away.
Even though it's wintertime and the mosquitoes are pretty much dormant.
But the fear of it,
Yeah.
The fact that it was brought up, the fear of it, is keeping a lot of major athletes out of the Olympics.
You're seeing like a lot of basketball players, Pau Gasol being a major one, and he's really one of the key players on that Spanish team. He's not coming. A bunch of people are just saying we're not going to come because we're worried about our safety on every level. And it's, you haven't really heard this. And I think because social media, especially now, I think
Even in Sochi, there wasn't quite the same level of fear in people.
People
not
are saying
what's more dangerous, though.
I mean, in reality, probably Sochi. But right now, it's a bad PR campaign that's happening for the Olympics, certainly among the athletes.
But what does this mean for the athletes who maybe this is their first or last chance at the Olympics?
Well, I mean, certain athletes will just go. They'll just go because they've spent their lives. You know, a professional basketball player like Pau Gasol, he can afford to say, I don't need to be there.
He's been to the Olympics. This isn't the first time he's had a chance. And, you know, I mean, the guy went to medical school. He could actually become a doctor if he wanted to.
He could cure Zika.
He could work on
right?
athletes
what is he
suffering.
Doing? Just practicing layups. Start curing Zika, pal. Dr. Pau.
But you've got, you know, if you've got a gymnast, if you've got a diver, someone who spends their life, who won't go into necessarily a professional rank where they'll make lots of money, they've devoted the last 4 years of their lives.
Yeah.
They're going to go no matter what. And this is their moment
Michael
to shine.
Phelps is going to go no matter what. He barely qualified in the qualifying trials, but he is going to go because he, in many ways, needs this.
Yeah, this is his time to shine. I mean, every 4 years, he is.
And you get a feeling that those Olympic athletes, especially being on that huge world stage, that chance to shine and represent your country in a way that doesn't exist, to stand on the podium and hear the national anthem being played for you, is something that I think if you've experienced that, you never want to let that go.
And there's chlorine in the pool, so
yeah,
yes, okay.
And
pretty safe.
And also that thing that if you do pee in the pool, it turns red. So I throw that, like that people used to do, our neighbors had that. Welcome to our ool. Notice there's no pee in it. Let's keep it that way.
Yes.
Okay, I know you guys want to talk about NBA, Kevin Durant.
That's the biggest story this week.
Taking his talents to Oakland, so that's exciting.
Yeah, you know, it was so funny because he's gotten so much grief for this. I mean, Kevin Durant, you got to understand what he meant to Oklahoma City. He started out with the organization when they were in Seattle as the Supersonics. Then they moved to Oklahoma City, and they had a legitimately awesome basketball franchise that made it to the NBA Finals. He actually brought them to the NBA. They didn't win. They lost, but he had this unbelievable franchise that put Oklahoma City on the map. When the tornado ripped through Oklahoma City and created so much damage, he spent $1 million of his own money to help people out. He was really part of the community. Now that he left and decided to go to Golden State,
everyone hates him.
Yeah, people are like giving him bad Yelp reviews for his restaurant, which, I mean, come on. Can we please move past that right now?
Yes.
Someone made a great comment. Jalen Rose, who's a basketball analyst for ESPN, former Michigan Wolverine, really,
former Indiana Pacer,
really smart guy, said he was at a game or he'd heard about a game when Durant was there in Oklahoma City and Obama, he spoke on the Jumbotron. And the second Obama's image went up on screen, everybody in OKC booed. Now, if you're a young black man in Oklahoma City and you say to yourself, that's my guy, that's my president, and I support him, and everybody in your town boos, if he has a chance to move to Oakland, which would probably give a different reception to Obama, what's he going to do? He's 27 years old. You got to think to yourself, he'd been there for as long as he could. He tried to give them a championship, and now he has a chance to win.
He's one of the top five players in the league.
Oh,
top
yeah.
Three
easily.
Or four players in the league.
Easily.
He's got a chance to win a ring. Now, Golden State now is the favorite. Everyone else in the West, the Clippers, the Lakers, everyone else can, you know, pretty much kiss their chances goodbye next year unless something miraculous happens. It looks like Golden State has the chance and the team and the core to go to the finals again. If LeBron can take the East did not do well. No one else beefed up their roster.
I mean, LeBron kind of did. They added Mike Dunleavy, who's a great sharpshooter, although he's had back injuries and whatnot. But I think
LeBron and the Cavaliers, you're almost gearing up for another potential final of the Cavaliers versus Golden State. And if LeBron's able to beat Golden State with Durant and Steph Curry and Thompson, everybody who's been on that team, they will put LeBron, I think, some people would argue that he's even better.
But a starting five for Golden State that includes Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, I mean, that is, you're looking at that and saying to yourself,
we should send that team to the Olympics.
Yeah, to represent our country. It's that filled with superstars. You say to yourself, we have never seen a team that's had that many guys who can score the basketball from anywhere on the court. The question is, can they play together? I mean, the great thing is that the NBA is in the best standing ever right now. They really are. Like, as a league, there's so much excitement. You've got this rivalry, East versus West, LeBron versus Steph. You have this amazing...
stars, you have great rivalries.
And all the best teams are kind of rising to the top.
So who's the star of the Warriors now? Is it
That's
still
a big
Steph
question.
Curry, or is it going to be Kevin Durant?
Steph Curry is the undisputed MVP. He was the unanimous MVP this year. But you got to wonder right now. I mean,
that's the question. And Steve Kerr is a great team guy. Steve Kerr played with Michael Jordan. He's the coach of the Golden State Warriors. He understands what it's like to be with a guy with a massive ego who is really the best of the best. One of the things he's going to have to do this year is make sure that everybody gets their amount of touches and that the ball gets passed around, and people are going to have to be unselfish in order for this team to succeed, because now you got three guys who at any point in time could take over a ball game, and you just have to make sure that all of them
get their shots.
Well, only the ones who can make the shots.
And
the thing is, for Golden State, everybody can make the shot, and that's going to be terrible on defense.
Charles Barkley said it's not fair. Charles Barkley was quoted as saying, it's not fair. Golden State is not fair to the NBA. That's how good they're going to be. Amazing.
All right, you guys, always fair here.
Yes. Yeah, it's always fair that we come on and discuss.
We are fair and balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Let's be honest.
Let's not go crazy here.
Yes.
All right, Sklar Brothers, Randy and Jason Sklar, check out their latest episode of Finding the Funny. It's up now at howl.fm. All right, that's it for us here at Press Play. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to weigh in on anything, please do, or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Again, thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.